From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They weren't interested in whether the loans would be paid back. That was somebody else's problem, translated through these credit derivatives and other unregulated instruments. They just wanted to do the transactions, make as many of these mortgages as they could. Every time they signed somebody up for a mortgage, they brought huge amounts of money in, and that's the way they profited.
American Casino, a new documentary, investigates the roots of the subprime mortgage meltdown and tells the stories of African-American families who lost their homes. We'll play highlights and speak with the filmmakers Leslie and Andrew Coburn. But first, 1 year ago today, U.S. and Iraqi forces arrested an Iraqi photographer working for Reuters. Ibrahim Jassim has been held by the U.S. military for the past year without charge. We'll speak with the Committee to Protect Journalists. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Central Intelligence Agency is refusing to release a series of key documents about its secret prison and torture program. The announcement came in response to a court-imposed deadline in a case brought by the American Civil Liberties Union. The CIA says releasing information on its so-called enhanced interrogation techniques would jeopardize national security by exposing classified intelligence sources and methods. The refusal comes 1 week after the Justice Department released a previously classified CIA report on torture at overseas prisons and launched a probe into the conduct of CIA interrogators. The investigation's been criticized for focusing on low-level operatives and not the Bush administration officials who authorized the practices the operatives carried out. The documents that the CIA wants kept under wraps could provide a wealth of information on the Bush administration's role. The documents include President George W. Bush's September 2001 authorization for jailing CIA prisoners abroad, cables between CIA officials and the secret prisons and their superiors in Washington, and memos by CIA lawyers on the operation's legality. Alex Abdo of ACLU's National Security Project said, quote, "The Obama administration must release all crucial documents that would shed further light on the origins and scope of the Bush administration's torture program. The American public has a right to know the full truth about the torture that was committed in its name," he said. In Afghanistan, at least 23 people have been killed in a suicide attack on a mosque near Kabul. The Afghan deputy chief of intelligence and at least two other government officials were among the dead. The intelligence chief, Abdullah Laghmani, was the bomber's apparent target. The private military firm hired to guard the U.S. Embassy in Kabul is being accused of gross negligence and inappropriate behavior in carrying out its duties. According to the Project on Government Oversight, or POGO, more than a dozen embassy guards have come forward with allegations against colleagues employed by Armor Group North America. Armor Group protects the U.S. Embassy under a $189 million annual contract. The firm's deal was renewed in July despite a critical State Department review of its work. The whistleblowers say Armor Group guards have conducted unauthorized, armed, nighttime operations in Kabul, violating contract rules. The guards dressed in traditional Afghan garb and hid in abandoned buildings. The guards were also said to have filmed and photographed themselves carrying out lewd behavior that included urinating on each other at alcohol-fueled parties. On Tuesday, State Department spokesperson Ian Kelly said the new allegations will be investigated.
Secretary Clinton has been apprised of the allegations in these documents and has directed the department and the Office of the Inspector General to take appropriate action. And let me just say that the Secretary and the department have made it clear that we will have zero tolerance of the type of conduct that is alleged in these documents.
The allegations come as a new congressional study shows the U.S. is relying on contractors in Afghanistan at an unprecedented rate. A Pentagon census last month revealed contractors account for 56% of the Pentagon's force in Afghanistan, outnumbering U.S. troops 74,000 to 58,000 by the end of June. The Congressional Research Service, or CRS, says the figure moves up to 65% if averaged over the past 2 years. The CRS says 16% of contractors in Afghanistan were performing security duties as of March, before President Obama's deployment of 21,000 additional troops had begun. The figures come amidst news the Obama administration's planning to vastly increase its reliance on contractors in Afghanistan in order to minimize the size of a new troop deployment. The Los Angeles Times reports the Pentagon's drawn up plans to add as many as 14,000 combat troops in Afghanistan by having them replace support units engaged in non-combat duties. Under the plan, the U.S. would avoid a major troop increase by replacing the non-combat soldiers with contractors. The outsourcing wouldn't completely offset an expected troop increase, but could reduce its size. A recent CNN poll, meanwhile, shows 57% of Americans now oppose the Afghan war, an 11-point increase from the end of last year. ABC News, meanwhile, is reporting the Obama administration's extended the private military firm Blackwater's contract in Iraq. The State Department will reportedly continue to use Blackwater to transport embassy officials around Iraqi areas. The contract was due to expire this month. Its extension is said to be indefinite until another deal with the military firm DynCorp is enacted. The news comes just 2 weeks before the second anniversary of the Baghdad killings of 17 innocent Iraqis by Blackwater guards. In other Iraq news, new figures show violent deaths have reached a 13-month high. According to the Iraqi government, 456 Iraqis were killed last month, including 393 civilians. It was Iraq's deadliest month since July 2008 and the highest civilian toll since April of this year. In Israel and the occupied territories, two Hamas fighters have been killed in an alleged Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip. They were apparently trying to plant landmines near Gaza's border with Israel. The deaths come hours after a Palestinian teenager was killed in an Israeli military shooting in the occupied West Bank. The victim, Mohammed Riyad Nayef, was 15 years old. Another three youths and an ambulance driver were also reportedly wounded. The ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya is in Washington, where he'll meet Secretary of State Hillary Clinton Thursday. On Tuesday, Zelaya criticized the Honduran coup regime for blocking his return and going ahead with an election campaign.
La democracia ha sido violentada en el país.
Democracy has been violated in the country by a military coup supported by business interests, not all, but certain sections that manage the economy of the country. In an effort to hold on to their privileges, they don't care about the development of the nation. I ask the international community, are you all right with the elections like those being held in Afghanistan, where every day people were killed by assassinations and bombs? Is that what we want for the Americas? Elections of blood and fire at gunpoint?
Elecciones bajo sangre y fuego, bajo bayonetas.
President Zelaya's meeting with Clinton comes days after a State Department review advised that his ouster be officially declared a military coup. The move would force the Obama administration to cut off as much as $150 million in funding to Honduras. Clinton has yet to issue a decision. In Chile, a judge has ordered the arrest of 129 former security officials for human rights abuses under the Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet. The move marks the largest ever mass arrests in cases investigating crimes committed during Pinochet's 17-year rule ending in 1990. The suspects all worked for the DINA, a secret Chilean police agency linked to scores of political murders and disappearances. Meanwhile, in Guatemala, a former top military official has become the first person to be convicted of committing disappearances under the Guatemalan junta. Former military commissioner Felipe Cusinero was found guilty of the forced disappearances of six peasant farmers in the early 80s. Cusinero was convicted before a packed courtroom filled with Mayan villagers and relatives of the disappeared. Hundreds of thousands of people died under the juntas, most of the killings committed by the Guatemalan army. In Ecuador, a lawsuit against the oil giant Chevron for environmental damage in the Amazon jungles being threatened by allegations of judicial corruption. Chevron's been sued for dumping billions of gallons of toxic oil waste into Ecuador's rainforest. An independent court-appointed expert has recommended Chevron pay up to $27 billion in damages. But now Chevron's released video, it says, shows the judge in the case, Judge Juan Nunez, meeting with an alleged representative of Ecuadorian governing political party and two contractors. Chevron says the video shows the judge discussing ruling against Chevron as well as a $3 million bribe for contracts involving another company. Chevron spokesperson Jim Craig called on Ecuador to investigate Judge Nunez.
We call on the Ecuadorian authorities to carry out a thorough, independent, and transparent investigation into this bribery plot, not only focusing on the conduct of Judge Nunes, but also into the serious indications of political interference in the case. The results of this investigation should be made public.
Judge Nunes has denied Chevron's allegations and said the videos were manipulated. He had been expected to issue a final ruling in the Chevron lawsuit before the end of the year. The original suit was brought 16 years ago. Julio Prieto, a lawyer for the Amazon residents, said Chevron is continuing its pattern of delaying the case.
There's 14 firefighters that have been injured and two have been killed yesterday.
Sorry, that was the wrong SOT. The Ecuadorian government has denied interference in the case and said it's investigating Chevron's allegations. Back in the United States, a new study says low-wage workers have been routinely denied proper overtime compensation and often paid less than the minimum wage. The joint study from the Ford, Joyce Haynes, and Russell Sage Foundations marks the most authoritative look at wage violations in more than a decade. 68% of workers surveyed experienced at least one pay-related violation in the previous week. 76% hadn't been paid overtime, while 26% weren't paid the minimum wage. The average worker surveyed lost $51 in wage violations the previous week, or 15% of that week's pay. Just 8% of those who suffered serious work-related injuries filed for medical compensation and missed days of work. Another study, meanwhile, shows top executives at the nation's leading financial firms have benefited from stock options that were awarded when share prices were low. The Institute for Policy Studies says the top five executives at 10 financial firms have seen their stock options increase in value by nearly $90 million. A large amount of the stock options have soared in value as financial markets rebounded from the economic meltdown. But while many executives have seen a windfall, some 160,000 employees have been laid off from the top 20 bailed out financial firms. A coalition of labor and governmental groups has launched a new campaign against the retail giant Walmart. The American Values Agenda for Change at Walmart is seeking to pressure the company on improving wages, health care benefits, as well as its environmental and labor policies. The group's website, wakeupwalmart.com, says it's issued a challenge to Walmart to agree to a series of new standards to mark Labor Day next week. In other economic news, newly released figures show the manufacturing sector grew last month for the first time in over a year and a half. The Institute for Supply Management says its August index also reached its highest level in 2 years. At the White House, President Obama welcomed the news.
Now, there's no doubt that we have a long way to go, and I and the other members of this administration will not let up until those Americans who are looking for jobs can find them. But this is another important sign that we're heading in the right direction, and that the steps we've taken to bring our economy back from the brink are working.
Later in the day, Obama hosted a group of U.S. Muslims for a dinner celebrating the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
Together, we have a responsibility to foster engagement grounded in mutual interest and mutual respect. And that's one of my fundamental commitments as president, both at home and abroad. That is central to the new beginning that I've sought between the United States and Muslims around the world. And that is a commitment that we can renew once again during this holy season.
And the Environmental Protection Agency has announced plans to soon declare carbon dioxide a dangerous pollutant. The pending formal endangerment finding would require the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas pollution under the Clean Air Act. The move follows an EPA ruling in April that said greenhouse gases endanger human health and welfare. Meanwhile, Senate negotiators have delayed introduction of a landmark climate bill cutting greenhouse gas emissions until later this month. The House narrowly passed its version of the bill in June. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The two American journalists who were detained in North Korea have described for the first time details about their arrest and detention. In an article published today in the Los Angeles Times, Laura Ling and Yuna Lee admitted they briefly crossed into North Korea on March 17th, but said they were on Chinese soil when they were detained. At the time, they were working on a story about human trafficking for Current TV. Ling and Lee described their arrests by writing, quote, We tried with all our might to cling to bushes, ground, anything that would keep us on Chinese soil, but we were no match for the determined soldiers. They violently dragged us back across the ice to North Korea and marched us to a nearby army base where we were detained. The two were held for 140 days and eventually put on trial and sentenced to 12 years of hard labor. They were freed last month after a visit to North Korea by former President Bill Clinton. While the case of Laura Ling and Yuna Lee made international headlines, as did the recent jailing of the American journalist Roxana Sabari in Iran, far less attention has been paid to another imprisoned journalist, Ibrahim Jassim, an Iraqi photographer who works for the Reuters news agency. 1 year ago today, U.S. and Iraqi forces raided Jassim's home outside Baghdad. Soldiers seized his computer hard drive and cameras. He was led away, handcuffed and blindfolded. For the past year, the U.S. military has held Jassim without charge. 10 months ago, the Iraqi Central Criminal Court ordered his release for lack of evidence, but the U.S. military refused to release him, claiming he was a high security threat. Reuters, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Reporters Without Borders have all called for his release. To talk more about the story, we're joined by Mohammed Abdel Dayem of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Dayem is CPJ's program coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. We did call the Pentagon to invite them on the program or provide a statement, but they didn't respond to our request. Mohammed, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about his case. What happened exactly 1 year ago?
They came into his house early in the morning, dragged him out in front of his family. He lived on the outskirts of Baghdad, just south of Baghdad. Dragged him out. His family has never seen him again. Like you said, he appeared in an Iraqi court, and the Iraqi court found no evidence against him and ordered him released. The U.S. military claims that they've since the Iraqi court session have uncovered more evidence against him and continue to hold him until today.
Tell us a little about Ibrahim. How did he come to work for Reuters?
He has been working for Reuters since late 2006. Up till that point, he had absolutely no altercations in terms of security, either with Americans or with Iraqis. A good journalist by all accounts, from everything we've heard. This was his only altercation. Unfortunately, it's cost him at least a year of his life so far.
As I said, we did invite the Pentagon on the program, but they declined our request. But I do want to read you a statement from the U.S. Marine Corps spokesperson, Lieutenant Colonel Patricia Johnson. She said this about Ibrahim Jassim, quote, "He is currently classified as a high security threat based on the intelligence information collected against him at this point of capture and since he has been in detention. Though we appreciate the decision of the Central Criminal Court of Iraq in the Ibrahim Jassim case, their decision does not negate the intelligence information that currently lists him as a threat to Iraq's security and stability." Your response, Mohammed?
Well, we haven't seen this evidence, so I can't really comment on it. We've since then met with the Pentagon. They've told us that this information is classified and that they can't share it with us or anybody else for that matter. And, you know, we've argued that this man deserves due process. And he has not gotten such due process. But the U.S. military insists that the information is classified and will not share it with anybody. And so we're sort of at an impasse at this point.
The Reuters editor-in-chief, David Schlesinger, has said this about the case, quote, "Reuters is concerned at the continued and protracted incarceration of Ibrahim Jassim and continues to urge the U.S. military to either charge or release him. Reuters believes any accusation against a journalist should be aired publicly and dealt with fairly and swiftly, with the journalist having the right to counsel and present a defense." So he hasn't been charged by the U.S. military, has been held for exactly a year as of today, but the Iraqi courts said he should be freed. What was that process? What information did they have? What evidence did they consider?
Well, the U.S. military at that point, this was November 2008, shared the information it had with the criminal court, the Central Criminal Court of Iraq, all its information as far as we know. At that point, the court didn't find enough evidence to hold Jassim and ordered him released. The U.S. military claims that since then they've uncovered more information against Jassim and that now they're holding him based primarily on that new information that has appeared or that they've uncovered since November 2008.
So the Iraqi government is not in charge here, though he's being held in Iraq. Whose custody exactly is he being held?
He is being held by the American military.
Mm-hmm. But the Iraqis have no jurisdiction. Why do you think this case is getting so little attention? I mean, compare it to the journalists who've just returned from North Korea who were detained for less time.
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, Iraq security in Iraq has improved a lot, and there are a lot fewer incidents with journalists in Iraq, and that may be one of the reasons it's getting less attention. Iraq has gotten less attention in the news in general terms, and so that might be one of the reasons.
Reuters has been hit hard, among others. Mazen Dana, one of the top Reuters cameramen, was killed outside Abu Ghraib. This was a few years ago, an award-winning cameraman. I think the words of the U.S. military was, "We engaged a cameraman. He was holding his camera." Then there was Taras Pratsyuk, who was a cameraman for Reuters April 8, 2003, a few weeks into the invasion, killed when the U.S. military opened fire at the Palestine Hotel. Also, Jose Coso was killed at that time as well, the cameraman who worked for Telecinco in Spain. U.S. has held other Iraqi journalists without charge, sometimes for years, and then released them. What is the record of these releases?
Well, none of the journalists that were held by the U.S. military since 2003 have been charged. Not a single one has been charged. They've all been released.
And how long were they held for?
Some for months, others for multiple years. Again, without charge. Jassem is the last remaining one, and so we hope that he's released soon and that we can, you know, turn that page.
Is it to stop him from working? Is it giving a different picture when Western forces, when Western reporters pull out, when it's a very dangerous situation? Those who are left on the ground are often from that country and are certainly depicting the war from the target end, let's just say, rather than, you know, embedded in the military.
Well, I'm not sure that is the case. It may or may not be. There are plenty of Iraqi cameramen and Iraqi reporters who are working for Reuters and other outlets, and I think they're more or less reporting from that same perspective, the Iraqi perspective. But regardless of that, Jassem deserves some kind of due process. The man has been languishing in jail for an entire year, and it seems like an open-ended process. It is not clear when this man will be released. According to the Pentagon, he has been assessed a security rating, and he will be released when they get to that point. They're releasing the least dangerous people first, and they're going down the list. And according to them, they'll eventually get to him. Well, eventually is not good enough, unfortunately.
His family speaking out?
They have. They have given a number of interviews in the past couple of months.
I wanted to turn now to Iran, the situation there, where the government continues to hold over a dozen journalists following the disputed presidential election in June. The Canadian-Iranian Newsweek journalist Mazir Bahari has been imprisoned since June 21st. Another journalist, Ahmed Zaid Abadi, recently went on a 17-day hunger strike to protest his imprisonment. Talk about these reporters.
Sure. Unfortunately, the Iranian authorities are holding around three dozen journalists at this point. And have released at least that many since June 12th. Among them are the two journalists you've mentioned. Bahari appeared in court and looked very, very much exhausted and looks like he had lost a lot of weight since he had been arrested. Zaid Abadi, who you've also mentioned, was finally able to meet with his wife, who's also a journalist and was also detained in early June and has been released since then. It took her 53 days to be able to meet with him, and he described the conditions of his detention, and they're frankly horrific. He's being held in a 1 meter by 1.5 meter cell that's about 3 by 4.5 feet, entirely alone for weeks on end. He went on a 17-day hunger strike and was essentially delirious and close to death at that point. He was released from his cell, fed, and put back into the same cell. These journalists are, at the very least, suffering from extreme mental exhaustion, if not more.
Well, also the American Shane Bauer, who did a report for Democracy Now!, Sarah Short and Joshua Fatal are also being held by the Iranian government, and we will continue to cover their case. We played one of Shane's reports once again after they were taken when they came over the border from, did not realize the border between Iraq and Iran was right where they were. They were hiking and were picked up by Iranian forces. Mohammed Abdeldayem, thanks so much for being with us. Committee to Protect Journalists Program Coordinator. coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. When we come back, we will go to American Casino. We will look at the economy today. Who's being hurt? Who's benefiting? Stay with us.
Thank you.
To see the images of Ibrahim Jassim's family holding up his photograph, the imprisoned Iraqi journalist from Reuters being held by the U.S. military in Iraq, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. That music that we just played, The People of Baghdad by Inam Wali. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The economy has a long way to recover from what's been called the Great Recession of 2008. At the heart of the meltdown was the subprime mortgage crisis that caused more than a million Americans to lose their homes and brought Wall Street to its knees. A new documentary that's opening today in New York takes on the subprime collapse, tracking its roots on Wall Street and Washington and profiling some of its victims, mainly African-American families who lost their homes. American Casino is directed by Leslie Coburn, who wrote and produced the documentary with her husband, journalist and author Andrew Coburn. They join us today in our Firehouse studio, but we first will turn to an excerpt of the film, which begins by looking at how deregulation of the financial sector laid the groundwork for the economic meltdown. This is American Casino.
To understand why this is like a gambling casino, you have to understand what's at stake here. On a December evening, December 15th, 2000, around 7 o'clock, Phil Graham, Republican Senator of Texas, then chair of the Senate Finance Committee, walked to the floor of the Senate and introduced a 262-page bill as a rider to the 11,000-page appropriation bill, which excluded from regulation the financial instruments that are probably most at the heart of the present meltdown. He not only excluded them from all federal regulation, but he excluded them from state regulation as well, which is important because these instruments could be viewed to be gambling instruments where you're betting on whether people will or will not pay off their loans. And he announced at the time that this measure would be a boon to the American economy and be a boon to Wall Street because they would be freed of any supervision in this regard. And that lack of supervision freed Wall Street to essentially shoot itself in both feet.
I worked for four companies on Wall Street. Three of them don't exist anymore. I don't think anything is really permanent in life. I mean, sure, my grandfather worked for the same company for, you know, 20 some odd years in the steel mills of Pittsburgh, maybe 30 years, I don't know, but he worked for the same company his whole life. Nothing's permanent anymore. The stock market goes south, you know, banks going out of business. It's just the way people in America live. I don't think anything I've done propelled or inhibited it. I don't think, no. I don't feel any responsibility for this mess at all.
It really started getting heated in 2004, 2005. The mortgage rates kept dropping. For prime mortgages, you know, the ones that most people get. And that made the others much more valuable because they offered much more yield. when you have that much cash flow that's extra, you can siphon off a whole lot more fees. And that is, you know, it's all about money. Subprime, in 2005 and 2006, the issuance was about $800 billion total. It's a river of cash. $800 billion, it will buy a lot of houses and do a lot of things, and you can tap into that. Your fees on that might be 4%. Okay, 4% of $32 billion.
If there's more demand for homes and more people securitizing mortgages, we would sell more bonds. And it could be $1 billion to $2 billion to $5 billion, you know, to $10 billion a month.
This is a Lehman Brothers bond done in early 2006. If you look here, you can tell how many mortgages are delinquent 60 days, are delinquent more than 90 days, how much money they've already lost, and how much real estate they've already taken back. That's in foreclosure. That's real estate they've already taken back and not sold yet. As you can see, you know, this is not going well. They've got $800 million, and you know, they've got 31%. That's more than 90 days delinquent.
Dr. Greenspan, you had an ideology. You had a belief that that free competitive, and this is your statement, I do have an ideology. My judgment is that free competitive markets are by far the unrivaled way to organize economies. We've tried regulation, none meaningfully worked. That was your quote. You had the authority to prevent irresponsible lending practices that led to the subprime mortgage crisis. You were advised to do so by many others. And now our whole economy is paying its price. Do you feel that your ideology push you to make decisions that you wish you had not made?
Well, remember that what an ideology is a conceptual framework with the way people deal with reality. Everyone has one. To exist, you need an ideology. The question is whether it is accurate or not. And what I'm saying to you is, yes, I found a flaw. I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I've been very distressed by that fact. But if I may I just finish an answer to the question previously?
You found a flaw in the reality?
A flaw in the model that I perceived is the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works, so to speak.
In other words, you found that your view of the world, your ideology, was not right. It was not working.
That's precisely the reason I was shocked, because I've been going for 40 years or more with very considerable evidence that it was working exceptionally well.
I want to thank you on behalf of the committee.
Alan Greenspan was the foremost proponent of these derivative products, credit derivatives, which are now at the heart of the meltdown, of them being not subject to regulation. And his theory was as follows, that he believed these instruments afforded banks the ability to move risk out to the economy. In other words, to exchange their risk of making mortgages and having to worry whether people would pay the mortgages, and creating financial products that would invite the rest of the financial world to participate in that risk. His theory was, well, this isn't making matters worse, it's making matters better, because banks, when they make all these mortgages, won't be subject to forfeitures. Unfortunately, what we have seen in our most recent history of this credit crisis is, yes, it spread the risk through the economy and made everybody subject to that risk, not just the banks. The banks got so cocky because they thought they were passing the risk off that the discipline of being worried about whether somebody could pay their mortgage disappeared. And they made as many mortgages as they could make. They weren't interested in whether the loans would be paid back. That was somebody else's problem, translated through these credit derivatives and other unregulated instruments. They just wanted to do the transactions. make as many of these mortgages as they could. Every time they signed somebody up for a mortgage, they brought huge amounts of money in, and that's the way they profited.
That was Michael Greenberger, the former director for trading and markets at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, in an excerpt from the film American Casino. It's opening today in New York. The film, directed by Leslie Coburn, who co-produced it with her husband, Andrew Coburn. They're joining us here in our Firehouse studio. It's nice to have you in New York.
Thank you.
That quote, Leslie, of Alan Greenspan is quite amazing as he's being challenged by Henry Waxman.
Yes. Well, when people hear it, they just find it extraordinary that this man could reduce the collapse of several American cities in terms of, you know, the millions of foreclosures, that he could reduce it to saying that it was a flaw in the model.
That he had believed in for 40 years.
Yes. And that it worked very well for 40 years. So he was just surprised that there was this flaw in the model. I mean, taking no responsibility whatsoever for what's happened. And yet it was Alan Greenspan who very clearly was the biggest advocate in Washington for what's called spreading the risk, i.e. that the banks would pass on the risk to all the rest of us, which is exactly what's happened. And Alan Greenspan thought that was a great idea.
Talk about deregulation, Andrew Coburn.
Well, deregulation, we start the film, I mean, the final descent into disaster from December 2000, when Phil Graham, acting on behalf of, it was basically a bill written by a bunch of Wall Street lawyers, smuggled a bill into the appropriations bill at 7 o'clock in the evening on December 15th, when they were all thinking about going home for Christmas, basically saying, making it illegal to regulate, among other things, credit default swaps, which were have been considered, which are, you know, basically gambling. I mean, it's a form, it's a bet. Like
making it illegal
to regulate them, making it illegal, impossible
to regulate
for state
them. Not just keeping them deregulated, but making it illegal.
Yeah, specifically saying that state and local, you know, state governments couldn't go after them under the gambling laws, because lots of states have gambling laws, and these very much, this really, you know, fits the bill as an instrument of gambling. And that's what they put in. So that was the crucial act of deregulation. But there's a long and hallowed history which went to, you know, create this disaster, the end of the Depression era reforms that have been put in place, which were all cheered on by both parties, by all administrations. But we stayed with that, because that's what the December 2000 Act was, what really sent us over the cliff.
Leslie Coburn, you began making this film in January of 2008.
That's
this
right.
is before all of the economic meltdown, the obvious effects of it.
Yes.
What made you start American Casino?
Well, there were a lot of things going on at that time. One, there had been a mini crash in 2007 in August of financials. And that tipped us off that there was something very serious going on. Also, two hedge funds of Bear Stearns collapsed in 2007. Leverage, if you looked at the market, leverage, which means borrowing, was completely out of control by the banks, the investment banks. At the other end of the scale, already there were foreclosures on every courthouse steps in America. You could go and find that houses were on the block. We live in Washington, we went to Baltimore and found that houses were being sold every 3 minutes on the courthouse steps. So it was time to do something. And we knew also that lawmakers in Washington were terrified that there were serious problems underlying this crisis, and it wasn't going to go away.
Your scenes of the auctions on the courthouse steps in Baltimore are amazing. I mean, it almost looks like there's no one there buying. It's just the auctioneer.
Exactly. All those properties were going back to the banks.
Yeah. The one guy you see in the auction scene, the one pyramid, he's acting on behalf of a vulture, a foreclosure vulture who buys up houses Rock
Bottom Pride. you see the auctioneer and his sidekick, and you see one guy in jeans and sneakers. I think it was sneakers. I'm not
That's
sure.
Right.
Holding a phone.
Yeah.
And he was making decisions, and he would respond to the auctioneer on the steps.
That's right. That's the market.
Houses.
But most of them go back to the banks.
We're going to play more from American Casino that's opening tonight here in New York. Our guests are Leslie Coburn, who directed American Casino, and her husband, Andrew Coburn, who co-produced American Casino. He is the author of the book Rumsfeld, The Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
All I wanna do is get away, get away.
This ain't right, yeah, times is hard. Don't take away her house, cause she got two jobs. And that's all in all, she working real hard. And plus she don't want all her stuff to be gone. She got kids crying inside, they dying. It's embarrassing to see all your clothes outside, because they is wrong, just leave her alone. She gotta find another place that she can call home.
Got three keys, yeah, right, more like nine, yeah. Living in a house for 30 days to find a new place to run away with all her kids. Never gonna leave him, cause that's what her mom did. Steady searching for anything to shelter. Help her hit up high, and she know times will get better. You know it's hard out here for young black mothers, protecting her cubs through the good or bad weather.
It's the percentage on your mortgage and your house is gone. It's the percentage on your mortgage and your life is gone. It's the percentage on your mortgage. Raise the percentage on your mortgage. Raise the percentage on your mortgage and your house is gone. Raise the percentage on your mortgage and your life is gone. Raise the percentage on your mortgage. Raise the percentage on your mortgage. It's a pain. See, my mother worked to death. She worked 24 hours, bugging nothing but less. She's strong, but I can see her breaking down. Cause when you get something new, they come around. Raising mortgage and causing stress. She needs some rest to get the best for me and her. Memories of how peaceful we used to be.
Losing Our Home by Rock Off Crew, written and performed by three 11 to 14 year olds from inner city Baltimore, featured in the movie American Casino, which is directed by Leslie Coburn, co-produced by Andrew Coburn. Andrew, talk about these musicians.
Well, Baltimore's a great musical city, and when we started to cover what was going on there in terms of foreclosures and the whole crisis, we figured that people were probably doing music about this. So we looked, and sure enough, I mean, actually, I think we collected 60 tracks of people talking from the inner city, but various aspects of it. And these, the Rock Off Crew, they're from, they got together in an after-school program for inner city youth, ages 11 to 14. They made this, came up with this heartbreaking track. I mean, we played two other tracks by other people in the film, but.
Well, I want to turn to another excerpt of American Casino that deals with the targeting of minority communities in Baltimore. This clip begins with Robert Strupp of the Community Law Center in Baltimore.
There seems to be enough evidence to suggest that minorities were put into these loans and deceived and misled into unsuitable loan products. Some of the deception that home buyers found themselves in is both at when they got to closing, and they were being told right up until the loan closing that their payment was going to be, say, $1,000 a month, and then they get to the closing and they're sitting and they're looking at the documents, and all of a sudden it says your monthly payment is going to be $1,500 a month or $1,800 or whatever the much higher number is. The confusion is that they weren't being told that they were going to have to escrow for the real estate taxes or the hazard insurance on their home. Now, on the flip side of that, we also have people who were being told when they refinance their loans that we could get a lower payment. What they weren't being told is that where they were currently paying the taxes and insurance on the new loan, they would not.
So the purchase price is $135, and then the interest rate is 11.125. So it was $108.27. The large loan is 6.6%, and then on this one, this is the smaller loan, the second one. This is the one that's 11.125. And as far as I know, it hasn't adjusted yet.
We got so lax in the way in which we conduct these closings that they were being conducted at people's homes by notaries. You could do a real estate closing by meeting this notary in the parking lot of a shopping center and do it on the hood of your car. there's nobody to ask questions of. There was the thickness of these documents is like a phone book in any given city, and there's no time for the borrower to even be able to digest what they're being asked to sign. And in very many cases, they're doing this late on their way home from work, so they don't have to take off from work. They have to pick up their children at daycare, and, you know, otherwise there's late fee penalties and that. There's just not an opportunity for so many of the folks who would not be in a position to understand what they were signing to do so. And there are even folks who are intelligent and trained as lawyers and in the real estate profession who admit that they don't understand some of the jargon that's in these documents. So how can you expect the average person to? It's a myth to say that, well, these documents were signed voluntarily by people who knew what they were signing. I don't buy that.
These loans are incredibly complex. In fact, we've looked at loan documents here, and counselors here will look at them and go, they can't figure them out. And they've been looking at loan documents for years in their lives. And there's a clause somewhere in it that they can't, it adjusts at this, it's based on a certain rate, it's tied to some interest rate or some treasury note of whatever that is very complex. Adjustable rate mortgages that only adjust one way, upward.
And how much is the payment on the first?
Even when a housing counselor was part of the process, frequently families would get to the closing table and suddenly were faced with a loan product that they didn't know about when they signed the real estate contract.
So he's already not going to make it.
I don't think some of the clients understood the mortgage they were getting. I don't think they understood that their income wouldn't support the loan. They were being told lots of different things to entice them into the mortgage. And I don't know who should pay for that, but I certainly don't think the homeowner should be.
That was Kara Stretch, a housing counselor at St. Ambrose, an excerpt from the documentary American Casino, directed by Leslie Coburn, co-produced with Andrew Coburn, both in our studio today as American Casino opens in New York at the Film Forum tonight. That's Wednesday night. Leslie, this description of the complexity, and then I think about the New Yorker Review, who said, when the Coburns turn to victims, they absolve them of responsibility for their troubles, which seems no better than a partial truth. Your response?
Well, I think that overall the New Yorker was very, very kind to us. I mean, David, he loved the film, so I don't want to be too hard on them. But I think that we heard so much, all of us heard so much, that it was the borrower's fault. How could they be so irresponsible to take out these mortgages that they couldn't afford? So we really spent a lot of time, months, talking to people who were in the trenches, like Strupp, like Kara Stretch, who made it clear to us that, one, you know, when you have this mortgage, as Strupp explains, you know, for working people, it's very hard to take time out of your day. So these things were scheduled at the end of the day. You know, you had to pick up your kids at daycare. You didn't have time to read the phone book size document. And in fact, none of us read that document. And as he points out, and the housing counselors, that they don't even understand this stuff because each document was different, tied to all kinds of really obscure numbers that no one can understand, and certainly not the borrower. People are not given the opportunity. They were enticed into this, as Kara says.
Yes, I mean, and you know, quite often they'd be told, you know, their payment would be so and so much, and then they get to the closing, and they say, oh, the payment will be different, or even, you know, that, as Denzel explains in the film, he got his first
Denzel
bill.
Denzel was a school teacher. Denzel
the school teacher, and it's more. And they say, oh, we didn't tell you that you had to pay, you know, escrow and insurance, which should have been there, should have been in the note. I mean, that was a very common trick, just to make the payment look smaller and to entice people in.
And the fact that most people who get subprime loans actually qualify for prime loans?
In 2006, it was 61%, according to the Federal Reserve at one point. So it's, yes. I mean, the whole, the any loan officer will tell you, if they're being honest, that the whole point was to get people into subprime loans because people up the chain made more money that way, whether or not the person had the income and, you know, other qualifications to be a prime
borrower. We had Elizabeth Jacobson on from Wells Fargo, who was really motivated when she saw her CEO on television saying, we don't do subprime loans. And right. She was the head of the division. And she said, for one thing, the loan officers got something like $5,000 or $6,000 for each subprime loan and maybe $1,000 for the prime loan.
Precisely. And so on up the line. I mean, for way up in Wall Street, for the bonds, I mean, for the instruments they were floating and selling, subprime was better, more yield. So the whole system was tilted to pushing people into these subprime loans.
The heart of your story, I think, are the personal stories that are told. American Casino tells these wrenching personal stories of people, mainly African-American, who lost their homes. This is Patricia McNair, a clinical therapist at Johns Hopkins Medical Center in Baltimore, whose house went into foreclosure.
At this point, the mortgage has been placed in foreclosure.
Where's the cat?
I don't know.
Cat, where are you?
And because of that, they've charged me $10,000 extra dollars in order to bring the account current.
Okay.
The mortgage went from about $800 a month to $2,000 a month.
Cat.
The minute I don't pay it, they're going to take the house. I got a letter with the ad, house, you know, 4405 Adele Terrace being foreclosed on with the date. Well, I screamed because I open it up and it's like seeing your life on this paper. And I almost died because they sent me that. I guess whoever sent it wanted me to know, this is very serious and you need to call us right away. And it was the actual ad from the paper. And that is the strangest feeling ever, to see it. You see, and then little print, you know, they got your name for the world to see. And it's there. And I'm like, oh, my God. So that was just the most terrifying thing.
I'm leaving tonight at 3.
Oh, no. No. That won't work. Not by yourself. No, we have to see how that would do that. I might need to try something else.
I need to be back by tomorrow.
What time?
Well, really 10 in the morning. But
I have mixed feelings about her driving by herself. She thinks she can do it.
3 o'clock in the morning. I know she can do it, but it's 3 o'clock in the morning that's disturbing me.
We weren't expecting the mortgage to jump as it did. We are two professional individuals. You know, we both are well-educated. Salaries are reasonable. And then we find ourselves in this situation. You know, it can happen to anyone. And that's the frightening part about this whole deal.
I do not want to be out on the street. And I know they will put me out. I've seen them put people out.
And then additionally, seeing how we as a family have been impacted as a result of what's happening. And then you read about it every day in the newspaper. You do see it on the news. And it's a sign of the time, but I think it's a sad commentary in the country in which we live is one where, you know, they talk about the American dream. We live in the richest country in the world, per se. And to have a system in place that makes it difficult for people, hardworking people, to own and maintain a home, I think it's a sad commentary in itself. And I think that's what's become more real to me as a result of having gone through this experience.
Before all of this started happening to me, I didn't read these things. They didn't apply to me. They weren't about me. But I read everything now, everything, because I know that if it's not me, it's still about me. And what I think, I'm amazed to know that everything we're doing here affects people for so far. It's like a ripple effect. I didn't understand that. I didn't know that there were investors who are getting rich off of people who are getting hurt. I didn't understand that. I'm now beginning to understand that it is a business. It's a much bigger business than I recognize, and that it's a business that needs some type of real regulations. I don't mean just to say they're regulations. I mean real regulations to protect the small people. That's what I think now. Before, it's like you just see this thing and doesn't mean anything. Now, when I read it, yes, it means a lot. It means that I didn't know that there was a town somewhere over in Denmark that was affected by this mortgage industry. I didn't understand that. Today, I'm understanding that it is, and it's more. So I just can't believe how we got like this. And when I say we, I mean we as a country. How do we do this when we tell people to own a house is the dream, and it's what our country's built on?
Patricia McNair, a clinical therapist at Johns Hopkins Medical Center in Baltimore, from the documentary American Casino, which was directed by Leslie Coburn, co-produced by Andrew Coburn. Leslie, what happened to Patricia?
Well, it was heartbreaking because when we first were filming with Patricia and her family, we met her first at a community meeting where people are trying to find solutions and avoid foreclosure. She hadn't been foreclosed on when we first started shooting, and tragically, she lost her house as we were in the edit room. This was a terrible thing because although it's happening to everyone, when it happens to someone who you've come to know very well, it's very upsetting. She's now renting. But that house was very important to her. You know, in a wasteland like inner city Baltimore, one street like Adele Terrace, where neighbors get to know each other and people are sleeping over at each other's houses, this is the kind of precious place that you want to preserve. And yet it's falling apart, too.
And the story of Denzel, the school teacher, who almost lost his home. What happened to him? And it tells the story of who owns what, who owns the note. At the beginning, it looks like he's out.
Yeah, well, he went into bankruptcy, which was a way of staving off being kicked out of the house. But he's basically hanging on by his fingernails, which is, you know, especially point because we got to know him so well, and he's got his garden, he's feeding, he's doing community supported agriculture. He's doing everything anyone living in a, you know, in a city should do. I mean, he's a teacher, he's a pillar of the community. And yet it's like, you know, one fingernail for Denzel. And it's, you know, and across the country, we have a situation now where millions and millions of people are in the foreclosure process. And it's really, millions of people are being just kicked out, but millions more are there at the whim of the banks. The banks, you know, according to how they want their balance sheet to look, can say, we'll have a few more this month, a few, you know, some fewer ones, people with no security.
These are often bailed out banks, bailed out by taxpayers that are making fortunes, that are giving millions of dollars in bonuses to their execs. And you have the homeowners, the people who've been most hurt at the bottom, who are not being helped out. Can you talk about the pools, Leslie? You go to California.
Well, I just wanted to say one thing about Denzel, which is that it was very important to us to be able to track one human being to those computer screens in Wall Street where you have these investment products. And we were able to do that and show that Denzel, who supposedly has a loan with Litton in Texas, Litton is owned by Goldman Sachs. We found him inside a Goldman Sachs investment product that had been put together at the time when former Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson was running Goldman. So it's a direct line from a high school teacher in inner city Baltimore all the way to the office of the
and
the
how
Secretary
many Goldman Sachs execs surround President Obama? We have to wrap now, but 20 seconds on the pools.
Well, the pool, this is a post-apocalyptic scene in Riverside, California, where you see pools, black pools, full of 700,000, 800,000 breeding mosquitoes. You know, this is now an issue of disease. We go around with these vector control people who are checking on, you know, worried about West Nile virus, rodent infestation in piles of 100% financing signs. This is really, you know, the end of the line.
Well, we're going to leave it there. American Casino, you've got to see it. Folks in New York are lucky because it's opening Wednesday night at Film Forum and then going around the country. Leslie Coburn is the director of the film. Andrew Coburn co-produced it. Again, it's called American Casino, and that does it for our broadcast. A very special happy birthday to Hani Massoud and Travis Collins. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Porto Caduce, Aaron Monte, Angela Comets, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.